self-esteem is very, very malleable in the early years. I've worked with children in preschool who are in just desperate trouble, and in 3 months you can have them going the right direction. You wait till you get teenagers, and I think most of you know, we have lots and lots of therapy and programs for teenagers and so on, and I keep wondering when society's going to learn to put that same money into worrying with preschoolers. We can identify these preschoolers who are headed that direction. We wait until they are teenagers to do anything about it, because that's when they make an impact on society and it begins to be a problem for all of us. Then we're willing to pay for it. It would be so much cheaper to take care of that at an early age, and I really urge you to get behind that legislatively. I mean, we all sit back and say, mm-hmm, that's probably true, go home and forget about it. There's all kinds of legislation being put forth with young children. A lot of it has to do with daycare. Many children in daycare, and I compare many years in a church preschool situation with the last 6 years that I have worked in the public sector in daycare, many more children in daycare are in bad trouble, and that is because one of the reasons children are put in daycare is because mother now has to support this child because father isn't, and so you get more of that kind of thing than you do in a nursery school setting, where the reason this child is in nursery school is because this is a neat family that thinks, gee, this little kid really is ready for something more, and there's plenty of money there to pay for that, because nursery school is seldom, the bill is seldom footed by anybody but the parents. Okay, I have to back up and say to the tape that I am Lois Brokering. This session is going to be on feelings with young children. I guess you deserve to know why I think I can sit in this chair when you're all sitting in those chairs, and I'm the one that does most of the talking. And I hope that today to let you do a little more talking than I did yesterday. I just have so much I want to tell you that I can't say it fast enough. But I come to this from many years of parenting. My kids are now all in their 20s, four of them, and I wish that I had known when they were little what I have learned through working with children. I started to teach kindergarten in a Lutheran church when my youngest was ready for kindergarten. My youngest was wandering around with some of our girls. You'll see him down at the pot shop. I wish that I had known more about how self-esteem develops and how to handle children's feelings and the kinds of things that I've learned the hard way, because I just desperately needed to do them in the classroom. And it's that kind of thing that I'm finding now at this elderly point in my life that I want to quick share with people who are, you know, working with young children, because I've through trial and error, I think, found some ways that really work and really fit with my Christian philosophy. I said yesterday that there's a proliferation of stuff on the market now that claims to be Christian parenting that I find just strictly Old Testament or strictly bad theology from the word go. And I think it is written by people whose moral development level is low. We don't have time to go into that today, but if you read anything about Kohlberg's research on how we develop our morals, we develop through the same kind of sequential patterns that we develop physically and intellectually and emotionally and every other way we develop morally. But some of us never get any farther than maybe the bottom levels. And when I read these things, I realize these people are coming from that perspective. I think the official point of view of the American government is pretty high, and the official point of view of our particular denomination is pretty high. Not that all of us achieve that level, but when you deal with children always on a low moral development level, you certainly inhibit their ability to grow, because one of the biggest ways children learn is through modeling, through watching the way adults do things, and then they try to copy that. Okay, now let's back up again to what we were talking about yesterday, which is how self-esteem develops. Our self-esteem then develops at a very, very early age. It begins developing immediately, and we add to it as time goes on. It is developed by the way the significant people in our lives treat us, and then the way we reflect on that treatment. Once our idea of who we are, someone used the word picture, our self-picture yesterday. I've never heard that used before, but that's a super way to explain it. Once your picture of yourself is firmed up, which may happen in the first 8 years of life, it'll be pretty solid, then it is very difficult for anybody to change that. And we tend to interpret everything that happens to us in light of that picture. Now, I'll give you as an example Edith Bunker, because I think you may all be familiar with Edith Bunker. Now, if you listen to those programs or watch those programs over a long period of time, you realize that Archie comes in and gives her put-downs constantly, doesn't he? But she always interprets them out of her high self-esteem that, oh, Archie, you know, it's always, you know, she's just fine about it. She doesn't take those put-downs as put-downs. If she had low self-esteem like Archie does, you see, then everything that happened to her would be because she was a bad person. We won't get into this, we'll leave this up to March. We'll talk about how this cultural low self-esteem of certain groups of people, women, blacks, Indians, how that impacts on our personal self-esteem. But I think that it really behooves those of us who are working with children to be very, very careful that we don't treat boys and girls differently in this sense that, you know, well, but you're going to grow up to be a man, so, you know, you're going to be way up there, but no, you're a little girl, so now don't speak up to the men kind of thing. I don't know how many times I have heard my mother use the phrase, one of the men, and I realize that she's got men as a group up on some kind of a pedestal, and so she's not taking them as individuals and saying, well, you know, this man may be really super, but, you know, that one's just as dumb as I am. Look at that. Here's a man that I'm smarter than. When I was studying at Columbia University, the head of the Home and Family Life Department, which I was enrolled in, told one time of a sort of survey that he did with a group of women he was working with. These women were wives of male graduate students that he had. They were not enrolled in any program, and he had a session with them. And he asked them how many of them wanted to marry a man who was less smart than they, as smart as they, or smarter than they. And almost all of them wanted to be married to a man who was smarter, someone they could look up to. Now, he said the problem with that is that women average out higher IQ-wise than men do. So there are not enough men to go around that are smarter than women. Now, I hope that the men aren't going to en masse get up and after being insulted like that.
Well, I think you can document that, Lois, because, you know, when you look at the, you know, the top percentage of every graduating class in the nation, look at how many more of them are women than men. And, you know, I think part of it comes from that thing you said yesterday about the emphasis of athletics. You know, we're more interested in being jocks than we are in learning to develop what God has given us.
But there's also a lot of research going on right now to show that girls are talked out of at a very early age, out of fulfilling their potential in math and science, because those are male fields in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think we may be shortchanging ourselves a great deal because we do put kids in categories sex-wise, and this has a lot to do with self-esteem. I have a friend who went through massive amounts of psychotherapy because she was brilliant. She has an IQ of close to 200. And this simply wasn't acceptable in her family. Women simply are not brilliant. And this family did not know what to do with it. And so as a result, because the family's idea of what a little girl was and what a nice little girl did was not realistic with what this little girl actually was. And so she grew up believing that she was not right somehow. She wasn't good. And as an adult, she had to overcome that. I really don't think this woman ever achieved her potential with an IQ like that. She's doing marvelous things. She's working in the State Department in Minnesota with the early childhood program. She's retired now. But I'm sure that she could have done, you know, a great deal more with that IQ had they said to her, you know, because you are very brilliant, you have a lot to give the world, and we need to develop that as much as possible.
That's changing a lot now.
Oh, I think it is. I think it is. Mm-hmm. I think that any of you that are public school teachers know that you can no longer use books that are sexist. And
however, there's a lot of information that says no, things are not changing. Mm-hmm. In fact, the employment situation, the authority situation, are such that women, it's a myth to think that women are being recognized more and have
their
opportunities.
A few in token individuals.
Yeah, right? It's a real case of tokenism, and that clouds some people's idea of reality.
The gap between...
But the whole economic structure is 31% less for women average than men. It threatened beyond I heard that Schlafly, for example, is supported by the American Manufacturers Association.
Right.
So I say, you got a whole mass, the whole economic thing appeared on cheap labor.
Women
and it threatens the liberty life out of the quality of the food.
Women make 59 cents for every dollar they
Well, what was the statistic I heard? I was so horrified about a woman that, female college graduate will earn as much as a male eighth grade graduate.
Mm-hmm.
The disparity between women's wages and men's is growing larger rather than smaller. So it's not getting better. There are a few token things. Well, anyway, this
and
is
the depressing thing is that many of these women are now supporting the family. They are the primary.
Yes, and there's still this myth that the men should have a higher salary because they're supporting the family. Have you all seen 9 to 5? That really makes a cartoon out of the whole thing, and it's hilarious, but it's based on facts, rather exaggerated, but lots of fun. Okay, two other things I want to take care of. Mary asked that we push the books that we have in the bookstore, so I'd rather modestly urge you all to run right over and buy a copy of the brokering's latest identified it's on a bottom shelf back in the farthest corner, so you have to walk all the way through the books to find it. It's in that corner of the bookstore. This is a new family thing that we're just starting. We have decided to launch a family publishing company, and this is venture number 2. The other one, Holy Holy, is also over there, and it's, some of the songs, well, all the songs that we used in Herb's session yesterday are in here, and we really think you'll enjoy it with your congregation. We put notes in it of how you can use it with children or with group celebrations. They're not all children's songs. Some of them are children's songs. Most of them are intergenerational songs that you can use with the whole congregation. How many of you belong to small churches? Under 200? Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a real book for, you know, a group where you have to include everybody at once. The songs in here that were written specifically for four-year-olds, like Little Rock that was written right here in Holden Village when Jerry Even was a little boy, was walking up this road just trying to figure out this little rock, and I just loved it. So Little Rocker out of that, right in Chalet 3. That's in here, but the meaning in that song is something that adults just go bananas over. Very simple, but profound. Other book, which I didn't write, but I really think you'll enjoy, I give this as new baby gifts now because for one thing, it is, I'm sure, no higher than a fourth or fifth grade reading level, which is where most of us read. Please don't be insulted, but that's where the average American reads. And that's why, one of the reasons I really like this, because everybody can pick this up and get something out of it. It is not gimmicky, is number 2 thing I like about it. But the main thing I like about it is that I feel pretty certain this gal has got to be a Christian, because her philosophy really agrees with my theology, I guess. There's one thing in here I need to caution you about. There's a point where she discusses feelings, which is an excellent chapter, where she says, if the child is hitting you, and you stop him, of course, and then you say to him, you may hit this pillow instead and pretend that it's me. Now, most psychologists disagree with that and say, you say to the child, here is a pillow. I see that you need to hit. You may hit the pillow, but you may not hit a person because that hurts. So that's a little bit different point of view, because as long as he's pretending it's you, he can still get the same, you know, thing out of it, where he needs to think about that. Okay, one last thing about, you know, oh yes, that's right, the tape needs to know the name. Your Child's Self-Esteem is the name of the book. It's by Dorothy Briggs, and it's published by Doubleday, and it's over in the bookstore. It used to be $2.95. It is still a grand bargain, though. I think it's gone up to what, $4 now?
$4.50.
$4.50. It says right here in big letters.
Run right over there and get a deal.
I'll save it till you get the loose.
Postage is 63 cents first pound.
Ordered by mail. Mary will appreciate it if you take them off the shelf over there. But really, this is a really helpful volume, and I think you will that you will find that it's value for you as your kids grow. It's not the kind of book you read through like a novel, and although most people find it difficult not to read it that way, I assign this to my students at the Minneapolis Technical Institute, and they end up reading the chapter I assigned, and then they go on and on. If they've got kids they're working with, if they've got to read more and more, and then they sort of leave it out so their husband will read it, send it to their daughter or whatever. Okay, one more thing about yesterday.
Sounds like a sexist statement.
the statement. And you see, I work with daycare people and nursery school people, and the pay is so low that I get usually, every class usually has a token meal, but occasionally there's a class with no meal in it at all. So, you know, any spouses in my classes are 99% males. It was sexist, and that's the reason why. I wish it weren't. I wish we had as many men working in daycare as the women.
Yeah.
The other thing that I want to come back to from yesterday, I've been thinking about the example that one of you gave of how you deal with what you label naughty behavior with your child. And as I've been thinking about that, I think I want to say that, especially onto the tape, and hope everybody buys all three and let that go, because I guess I would be afraid that the child would misinterpret that statement. The statement was, I tell the child that behavior was something that a naughty girl would do, but see, I see that you're sorry for it, so I know that you're not a naughty girl. I think that a child might very easily conclude that I must be a naughty girl because I did it. Even though I'm feeling sorry, I actually did it. And I think there's a great danger in putting value judgments on children's behavior. This behavior is good, but that behavior is bad. I think it might be better to say, this behavior is not acceptable to me, your mother, which probably raises, especially a preschool child, to the next moral development level. The bottom moral development level is the child reacts for, well, the very bottom one is he behaves in order to avoid punishment. You do not want to keep a child at that level. There are adults in prisons. In fact, somebody did some research on some prison in Florida, and the bulk of the men in there were still at that moral level. It was okay if you didn't get caught. The only reason something was wrong was because you might get caught, and then you get punished. The next level up is where most little children work, and that's to please you, to get a reward. And little children are desperate. That's why it's so easy to control their behavior, because they are desperate to have you like them. Not just like the behavior, but to like them. And that's our trump card with working with little kids. This need for acceptance from adults is such a strong motivator. It's the number one motivator. And that's because the moral development level where little kids are is pretty much my behavior is based on getting a reward. The reward does not have to be a tangible reward. And it should be. You should try to get kids to behave for intangible rewards, because this behavior makes me feel good and I see that it makes the people around me feel good, rather than if I behave like this, I'm going to get a lollipop, or I'm going to get a new game, or I'm going to get to go shopping with mother, and otherwise I get left with a sitter or something. Okay, I wanted to remark on that because I thought about it later, and then I felt kind of guilty that I had, you know, not reacted to it. It's one way of solving it, but I think it's a way that the children might really misinterpret and say, then I'm not really very good. I'd rather say to the child, I did not like that behavior, and I wish that you didn't do that. Then the child can decide whether or not they will do it, and whether or not it was good or bad. And they'll probably decide not to do it because they don't want you to feel dissatisfied with what they're doing. But it doesn't talk about whether the person is good or bad. You see, you really want to watch your language that labels the person, the I am-ness of a child, or anybody you're working with. I heard a reaction yesterday secondhand that one of you said, this isn't just for parents, it's for anybody. Because, you know, when you're talking about self-esteem, this is something you never outgrow. Your self-esteem is always being shifted around. So you...
Could you briefly then just go on up with your moral development things?
Well, if I do, we're not going to get into it.
Sorry, is that briefly?
Yeah.
It is important.
The next session is where middle-aged kids are, the next whole section, which is a group orientation. You know, if our group doesn't do it, then I don't do it. I had a friend one time whose youngster came in when I was there, and he said, Mom, can I blah, blah, blah? And she said, this gal, Vera Haugen, Flavish. She said, no, you can't. And he said, well, why not? Everybody's doing it. And then he shot up and he looked at his mother, and she just sat there and looked at him. She didn't say a word. And I thought, they've been through this before. Because he looked at her and he says, I know, I'm not everybody. I'm a Haugen. At his age level, that was sufficient to know that the Haugens didn't do this. It was all right if the neighbors did this. You didn't need to say, well, you know, those terrible neighbors. It was just that our family didn't do this kind of thing. And I remember dealing with this with my two youngest kids, when they were 3 and 5, we had some new neighbors moved in whose children were used to, you know, using very strong physical behavior to get what they wanted. They had not discovered words as a way to move people. And they threw rocks immediately. Well, this is a really new ball game to my youngsters. They had never, ever played with anybody who threw rocks before. So their immediate 3 and 5-year-old reaction was to throw rocks back. When I discovered this in horror, I said, hey, you can't do that. You know, we just don't do that. That's dangerous. People get hurt that way. It's very hard for a 3-year-old to understand that somebody may get hurt that way. But I said to them, you may not do that, and if the friends want to do that, you say to them, we don't play that way, and when you want to play a different way, ring the doorbell and we'll come back out, because we're going to go in. We don't play that way. And it worked. These 2, 3, and 5-year-olds, the 3 and 5-year-old kids, were able to then manipulate the behavior of the neighbors' 3 and 5-year-old kids, because there wasn't anybody else to play with. And if they wanted to play with my kids, they had to play on my kids' terms, which was, I felt, at a higher level, at least a different, it was a higher moral development level anyway. So, you know, you can use this with middle-aged kids to get them to do what you want. The brokerings do not do this, the Hobbins don't do this, so you can't do it. That's a social orientation. You know, the America love it or leave it syndrome is the mentality is the bottom of that level. As you get higher, if it's good for our if it's good for people in general, we may do it. The highest levels most of us never achieve, because they are even beyond that. I may get killed for doing this. This is the kind of people who were able to run down to Selma and, you know, put their life on the line, get in prison and so on. You may get punished for taking this moral level because it goes against what the consensus of the group is, even though from your perspective you can see that it's better, what you're asking for is better for the group. And there's always this conflict in our society because most of the people in our society are at that middle level rather than the highest level. So the leaders up at the top level, like Martin Luther King, are asking us to do things that we can't understand, you see. Because we're very attracted to the next level, but we can't understand. Well, I shouldn't say level. There are 3 levels, but there are 6 stages, roughly 6 stages within those levels. And you can understand the stage that's immediately above you, and you're attracted to it, but you can't comprehend how people behave 2 stages above you. So see, if you're working at the America love it or leave it mentality, you simply won't understand a Martin Luther King who's willing to stand on a balcony when you know darn well somebody may be there with a rifle. I mean, I'm sure Martin Luther King knew that there was that possibility, and it happened. Okay, now let's get to today. We are halfway through today's session, and we need to get on to today's topic here, which is handling feelings in a helpful way that helps kids grow, that helps their self-esteem grow. I don't know whether we really fully established yesterday the really bottom line with self-esteem, that all of our behavior depends on our self-esteem. When Christ said, you know, love one another, love other people the way you love yourself, I don't see that so much as a directive as a statement of fact. You can't do anything else. Walt mentioned that in his session an hour ago. You simply have no choice. If you don't love yourself, you aren't able to love other people, and you're going to give them put-downs. That's why it's so crucial for parents to try to develop their own self-esteem if they're going to raise kids that are happy, healthy, mental people. So, you know, if you find yourself feeling nasty toward other people a lot, you know, start asking some questions. And if you find yourself thinking that your kids are out to get you, then you really better ask some questions about where your own self-esteem level is and make some, you know, attempts to raise it. And I did say yesterday that as Christians we have just, I think, the ultimate answer, because God created us. We have to be good. And because God sent his son to die for us, we certainly are of inestimable value. So we need to discount all the stuff that is coming in from others in our lives that says to us, you really aren't very good. You know, you're only a woman, or you're just a carpenter, or, you know, you're just dumb, or whatever you're getting from little on. I think our whole educational system is changing to the better in allowing the diversity of people. And here again, if God made me this way, there's got to be something good about it. Why should I have to fit into some category? Why should I have to be able to understand phonics just because I'm 6 years old, if I'm not ready for that, or if I grasped it at age four. But many, many kids that are brilliant go through school feeling like they're less than good because they don't fit the box. They already knew that, and here we are studying it today, so what's wrong with me? You know, that I'm sitting here bored, and a teacher may treat me as though there's something wrong with me. I'm a naughty boy because I'm sitting here wiggling, or like one of my kids drew stars on his notebook, his math workbook, and he dog-eared the pages, and the teacher was terribly upset with that. He was being a naughty boy. He was doing things in her that were in her way. But the math she was asking him to do at age seven, he did at age four, you see. But it just made her angry that this was boring to him. Now that had to do with her low self-esteem, but it made him feel like he wasn't, something was wrong with him, and he couldn't quite figure out what it was at age seven, but he knew there was something wrong. He wasn't the kind of student that he should be because the teacher didn't approve of him. Okay, parents and teachers both give off those messages. Body language and tone of voice are really, really crucial. You may think you're saying the right words, but you get an edge on your voice that says the wrong thing. I'll give you an example of that. A friend of mine who discovered that her kids were beginning to power struggle, and she read a chapter in a book called Children the Challenge by Rudolf Dreikers, which is very good, but I think, again, he writes at a little lower moral level than Briggs, so I'd like to recommend her instead. But if you're having trouble with kids that are power struggling with you, do read that chapter. I think it's chapter 6 in there, because it's really good. He tells you how you've got to withdraw from that battle. You never can outdo a kid. You know, it's just hand thing. And they're always going to win somehow. You may think you've won temporarily, but they always start a new battle and get you somehow. You don't want to do that. You don't want kids to feel like life is a competition between me and mother. We're both on the same side of the battle rather than opposing sides. Well, anyway, she thought she was going to use this technique now of handling these situations with her child. So she was riding in the car with Melissa, and Melissa took off her gloves. The reason Melissa took off her gloves was because she found she could get a rise out of mother by sitting around with her gloves off. So her mother said to her, put your gloves on or your hands will get cold. And then she remembered Dreikers, and she thought, now I won't say any more. I've told her, and she knows that. Now the logical consequence of her not putting on the gloves is she's going to get cold hands, right? And it's not going to kill her, so maybe she'll learn to wear gloves if her hands are uncomfortable enough. And I did point it out to her that that's why I bought her a pair of gloves. So, you know, instead of letting it go at that, now, when they got out of the car, this child says, my hands are cold, and she's whiny, icky, you know, obnoxious. And the immediate maternal response was, see, I told you your hands would get cold if you put your gloves on. And, you know, then, of course, the kid immediately shoved the gloves back in the pocket because mother was keeping the power struggle going. Now, I am on top of you. I told you so. So, you know, what mother could have done was say, yeah, hands really get cold when they don't have gloves. That's probably why somebody invented gloves. It was clever, wasn't it? Then the child could conclude and have the freedom to put the darn gloves on and warm up her hands, see? But mother kept this power struggle going with her strong, icky tone of voice to this child. See, I told you so. Then it suddenly she realized what she had done, and that she wasn't using logical consequences at all. She was using the consequence just as another punishment. So it's, you gotta watch your tone of voice. Yesterday I said to you, be careful when you say something, say to yourself, before you say it, ask yourself, will this remark encourage or discourage this child? Try to get the kid's point of view on this. How would I feel if someone said this to me? You know, sometimes it's hard for us to remember what it was like when we were children. And I think you can use that no matter who you're talking to. Because I really feel like the Lord expects us to go around putting people up, not putting them down. And when you make a discouraging remark to your garbage man or to some clerk that's being nasty to you, how do you know that clerk's feet may just be killing her? And she's just had so many snotty ladies come in, and you're the straw that breaks the camel's back, and so she's insolent to you. And you just back to her because clerks aren't supposed to be that way. Well, feelings now. if you learn some nifty tricks of fielding kids' feelings, and the reason I'm putting feelings before discipline, which we're going to talk about tomorrow, is that you can avoid a great deal of the need to discipline children. The reason for this is because negative feelings always precede negative acts. Believe that? Think about that. No kid walks out and hits another kid just out of the clear blue because, oh, that was fun. You know, he always does it out of some perspective of negativism. He's frustrated. He's been put down. He's feeling anger for some reason or other, and that's the only way he knows how to tend to that anger. So what you want to do is to jump in there before he hits and give him some clear way of dealing with that anger. Now, knowing that the bulk of this audience probably came from a Lutheran background, which is generally Northern European, I would guess, and I won't ask a show of hands again, but I would guess that most of you were raised the way I was, that if you're a good Christian, if you're a nice person, particularly if you're a nice little girl, you simply don't get angry. You see, anger is sinful. Now, I don't know what that theology does with the story of the Lord in the overthrowing the money changers' tables in the temple. I've often wondered how they discount that story in the Bible. We have many stories in the Bible of Christ exhibiting feelings. He cried over Jerusalem. Think of the feelings exhibited in the Garden of Gethsemane, to say nothing of that anger that was shown over those people in the temple. So, you know, we have this wide range of feelings, which to me says loud and clear, Christ was not only human, but it's legitimate for me to feel these feelings. I feel them, they're there. And what we tend to try to do with kids is, and not only with kids that we're dealing with, but with spouses and siblings and, you know, friends, it is uncomfortable to have somebody around who is dealing with negative feelings. Have you ever been with somebody who's dealing with grief? I've got a neighbor right now who's one of whose twin daughters was just killed by a hit-and-run drunk teenager, a 16-year-old who had no business having any alcohol, who had just gotten a driver's license, who hit this kid and flew off and pulled into a neighbor's driveway and started tossing out the beer cans real quick so he wouldn't get caught with the evidence. And this woman is so vindictive. I said, well, I wonder what's happening to that kid's, you know, if anybody's dealing with that child's guilt feelings. She said, he doesn't feel guilty. People like that just don't even feel guilty. I guess I can't accept that. I think he's probably feeling guiltier than he can handle, and if he doesn't look like he's feeling guilty, it's probably because the only way that he knows to deal with his guilt feelings is to deny them and say, you know, and to give remarks that say, I don't feel guilty at all, it was nothing, you know. Because we've been taught to deny our feelings, we haven't been taught how to deal with our feelings. So when you get feelings that are overwhelming, the only thing to do with them is either to lay them on somebody else or to shove them. I was in a classroom one time where I suddenly realized that the kids were blaming each other all the time. I looked at the clock and I decided I was going to keep track. And in an hour and a half's time, I counted 45 instances of 20 small children, 3, 4, and 5 years old, blaming each other. 45 instances in an hour and a half. Now, you know, that's way out of line. Well, then I began to listen to the two adults that were running this situation. And what I discovered was that when anything happened, they had to find out who left that wallet on the floor. Whose coffee cup is that? Why isn't it, you know, who left that there? Well, that should be back in the, so that you see there was this constant blame. So what the kids were doing was saying, you know, he left that coffee cup there, you know, or I didn't do it. I saw one child sitting with his feet out in front of him like this on the floor as the teacher dismissed children one or two at a time to go to the toilet and the sink to get ready for lunch. The child sitting right next to him got up and tripped over those feet. Those feet had been there for 5 minutes at least. She tripped over them and turned around and said to him, Corey, why did you trip me? You shouldn't have put your feet out there just when I was passing. You see, she had to do that so that she didn't seem like some clunk that didn't see his feet out there. Now, I don't think she did it consciously at all. She may not have even noticed, well, obviously she didn't notice those feet. But it was more comfortable to immediately blame him, then it was off her back, you see, than to deal with the guilt feelings and say, gosh, Corrie, I'm sorry I tripped over your feet. Because what she had to worry about was that teacher might say to her, Carla, be more careful. Didn't you see Corrie's feet out there? You see, so this is another thing that parents do. It's much more important to deal with the fact that the coffee cup needs to get back over to the dining hall than to worry about who's leaving it there. You see, but we want this nitpick. Now, I think it's very important for the adult to be aware of who's leaving it there, because you may find that everybody's putting their things away except Johnny. Now, that says to you not that Johnny needs to be blamed, but that Johnny needs to be helped. Why is he constantly forgetting? Is he developing in a way that says, I'll let other people do my dirty work for me. Why should I do that? So that he's insensitive? You don't want that. But let me tell you, you are not going to get him to be sensitive by constantly pointing out to him in a blameful way that he's being insensitive. That will do just the opposite. I mean, think about how that feels. See, what's he going to do with those feelings? He's going to try to avoid those feelings. We try to avoid guilt. We try to avoid it so much that in the 60s, I don't know how many books were put out about why you shouldn't feel guilty. You know, why shouldn't we feel guilty? If you do something bad, you should feel guilty about it, shouldn't you? But if you're a Christian, you have this marvelous thing that you get forgiven. And I don't know why we can't deal with children that way, too. Why can't there be forgiveness in a child's world? I like to say to kids, gee, I see that there's still a coffee cup out there, you know, but you'll remember tomorrow, I think, instead of blaming them for what they did today. How much nicer it is if somebody says to you, wow, the table looks super. Everything's clean but that one little piece of chalk put away. Or says, after you've spent the time taking a million articles off that table, there's still a piece of chalk on there. Now, you know, which way made you want to go get that piece of chalk and put it away? And which way made you want to run and hide? Okay, you know, I wasn't the one who left the chalk. See, okay, kids avoid negative feelings. We all avoid negative feelings. They are uncomfortable. Yesterday we talked about psychological dissonance. When you have an uncomfortable feeling psychologically, you try to get rid of it. If you feel uncomfortable physically, you recognize, you know, if you're hungry, you head for the refrigerator. If your bladder's too full, you head for the toilet. When you're uncomfortable physically, you try to do something about it. If you're tired, you want to take a nap. You may withdraw, and you know, mentally, because you're being bombarded too much. We do the same thing psychologically. We try to avoid uncomfortable situations. If you are with a person who makes you feel uncomfortable, my husband said something to me the other day about, oh, so-and-so is here. Have you visited with her? And I said, no, and I probably won't, because this is someone who makes me feel uncomfortable, and I guess I should feel to myself, maybe she's got a need that I can help, and I should feel strong enough to go and say, you know, I wonder why she feels this way. What can I do to lift her self-esteem and to make her feel better? I don't feel like putting the energy into that. That's not very nice of me, you know, because she makes me feel so uncomfortable because she wants to feel superior to me, and she makes remarks. And then I've got to deal with those remarks and say to myself, you know, why is she doing this, rather than, gee, it doesn't even get into words with me. It's just an uncomfortable feeling. I'm avoiding it. I'm avoiding this person because she makes me feel uncomfortable. Okay. So our response to negative feelings with kids is usually that we use reasoning or logic, or we give judgment on it. You shouldn't feel that way. Or we give advice. When my youngest lost his first girlfriend, he got more advice from kids. Go get another girl that's really good looking and take her to a party where you know Susie will be. Make her feel bad. That was advice. Well, he really didn't want to do that, because at this point he realized that this relationship should start. He didn't really anymore want the relationship, although it had been a very traumatic breakup, and he was hurting. Oh, he was hurting so badly. But he said, Mom, it's like, you know, they're putting straws out there, and I grasp them, and then I pull them down, and I see that's not going to work. It really wouldn't achieve anything to take a glamorous girl to a party where she was going to be and try to make her feel jealous. It really wouldn't get rid of the hurt at all. It would just keep it going. Reassurance, oh, it'll be okay. Or denial, you don't really hate your little brother. The kid hates his little brother. Right at this moment, he hates his little brother. He had to say to him, honey, Jesus doesn't like little boys that hate their brothers. Only drives him away from you and gives him two reasons now to feel hatred. Now he can feel hatred toward you too, because you're telling him that what he's doing is bad. Okay? That is such bad theology anyway. Jesus loves him in spite of his hating little brother, and he needs to know that. The fastest way to get rid of negative feelings is to express them. Now, whenever I do sessions on feelings, there are always people who disagree with this. People should not express negative feelings is sort of a given in our society. And yet I'm telling you, if you don't express negative feelings, you are in trouble. We do express negative. They're going to go somewhere. And if you shove them inside of you and you teach children to shove them inside of themselves, they're going to come out somewhere. They may come out someplace that embarrasses you. You don't let the kids, your child hit his little brother, and you just say you simply can't do that and you don't deal with it. So he goes out and he hits a little kid on the playground. My insurance man told me one time that he was having a problem with his five-year-old. He had hit, and I think secretly down underneath he had a little pride in this, because the kid had hit a 10-year-old on the school bus. You see, and that he took on a bigger kid. I think father had some little macho pride in that, but yet he was a born-again Christian, and he knew this was wrong. His kid must not hit on a school bus. Okay, I'll tell you more about him tomorrow, because I asked him how he handled it, and I was kind of floored at what he did and the logic of his father's reaction to it. But, you know, I think maybe what the child was reacting to was the pressure that he has at home with a very authoritarian father. And he can't hit father when he's angry, because nice little boys do not hit their fathers. But there's no place given to him to take that anger and that need to hit, and so he takes it out on whomever he can. And probably the 10-year-old he hit was some little guy with a self-image about this big. Well, there are 10-year-olds, and 5-year-olds can bully. And that's too bad. But that 10-year-old needs his ego boosted a lot.